And we have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk, formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning. He's feeling a little ill.
Recovering from a little bout with food poisoning.
Yeah, so we're wishing him well and glad that neither of us have that.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So, plenty to cover this week, starting with some good news coming out of via the mayor's office.
Yes, the mayor's Emergency Task Force on Unsheltered Homelessness gave their recommendations to both the mayor and the city council this week on Wednesday. And they recommended in their report, it was a really very good report, they recommended that three of their items be done immediately. One of those is to change city law and city policies to allow more tent cities on public and private property. And in the report, they recommended 7 tent cities with up to about 100 people allowed in each one. And that the city allow them on both public and private property so that the city actively look at some public property that is sitting vacant right now that could very well be used to host one or more of these tent cities, as well as making it a lot easier for groups like nonprofits and churches, which have hosted a lot of temporary tent cities here in the city of Seattle over the past 10 to 15 years, to make it a lot easier for those folks to get a permit and to set one up and to manage one. Now, another of the recommendations that they made was to open more shelters for homeless youth and young adults and to ensure that there are spaces reserved specifically for them, because a lot of homeless youth and young adults are at a point where they could easily transition from homelessness into housing and work, but they tend not to take advantage of a lot of the city's social services that would allow them to do that. They tend to have a greater mistrust for the city's social service agencies in the first place. It would be good to get them into, I don't want to say into the system, but get them aware of what things they can take advantage of in order to move out of homelessness. Now, they also recommended that the city use city-owned facilities, including community centers, to provide night shelters and day services for the homeless. And this is a recommendation that homeless advocates have been making for a long time, but it's one of the ones that have gotten a major pushback from the mayor and from the city council over time. The mayor in particular has said that he likes a lot of the recommendations in this report, and he's going to put forth a plan next month to the city council to use some of the money set aside in the recent city budget that was set aside to put into practice some of these recommendations made by the task force. He's going to recommend that they use some of that for the tent city proposal, but he's pushing back against using city-owned facilities, particularly community centers, for homelessness services. He wants to reserve those for the elderly and for kids. Well, you know, I mean, the homeless come in all ages, shapes, and sizes. So you would think they would also be able to find some things at city-owned community centers that would help them as well. So it was a good report, and so far an encouraging response from the mayor. We'll see what he puts forward in his proposal next month. He was also very verbally encouraging about the $15 an hour proposal. But then what he put forth for the city council was somewhat less than what he had indicated he would support. So we'll see if what comes out of his office next month.
Still, it's a big switch from when Craig Nichols was in power.
Yeah, it is a big switch from the Nichols administration when the city was pursuing clearing homeless encampments as if sweeping people out of their encampments, bundling up their goods and literally stealing them from them, was going to make the homeless just kind of evaporate into thin air, which, as we know, doesn't happen. So, and I think his response to the report is also comes from the pressure that he's been getting from the Downtown Business Association to do something about the people who are sleeping in their doorways, you know? And I just want to say, well, yeah, you know, you get homeless people sleeping in your doorways when you insist that the city push people out of homeless encampments in the first place, which was happening all throughout the Nichols administration and continued at a lower level during the McGinn administration. So I just want to say, yeah, this is a big, almost a 180-degree turn. If I say, Murray is really serious about supporting expanding tent cities.
They also had a item in the report about building small-scale housing like they've done.
Yeah, like cottage housing, mm-hmm. which they've done in other parts of the country to house homeless folks, you know, and it would be a change for here in the city of Seattle. But, you know, I just am not sure where they would do that. We're already suffering from a shortage of buildable spaces for affordable housing, much less for small scale housing. So I'm not sure if that would mean something like the very sort of mini apartments that they're building right now or wanting to build right now for geared particularly towards young high-tech workers. I don't see that as something that's going to be an easy solution or a quick solution for homelessness here in Seattle. But it would be something to look at maybe for other parts of the Puget Sound where there's more land available and where land is cheaper.
Yeah, given that the overnight counts that they do yearly are for the King County.
For King County alone, yeah. And, you know, the number of shelter beds here in the city of Seattle is around 1,700. And the number of people in the last all-night homeless count was somewhere north of 3,000. So clearly there's a big demand for some way to get people off the street or to get them into some kind of transitional housing, which tent cities can often be, because it's the only place for a lot of people to go where they have a permanent place to stay. It almost functions as an address for them, where they can get social services, where they can get regular meals, where they can get support from a community of any kind. So tent cities do serve a very, very important function.
All right, moving on to the state level, and Governor Inslee had a busy week, starting with the carbon cap and trade plan.
Yeah, he proposed early in the week his carbon cap and trade plan. It would be similar to California's cap and trade system. He said it should raise about $1 billion in the first year, beginning July 2016, which is when it would go into effect if the legislature were to pass this plan. Now, the way it would function is the state would set a cap on greenhouse gas emissions. The largest polluters in the state would pay a fee per metric ton of greenhouse gas emissions, with the price being set at an auction. Any of those large polluters that then actually emit less than the cap for them would be able to use the difference as a credit that they could then sell to another polluter who wants to pollute over their cap. That's what the cap and trade feature is of the cap and trade. That's a trade feature of the cap and trade system. Now, about 130 large sites would pay the fee. That would include refineries, power plants, steel mills, anyone who emits more than 25,000 metric tons of carbon per year. Now, the cap would decrease over time, so the permits would be fewer in number, and they would also increase in value. So that would provide more incentive for businesses to instead of paying the fee, which would be an ever-increasing fee, to cut their emissions. That's how the cap-and-trade system is supposed to work, to limit and scale back greenhouse gas emissions. Now, Inslee says that the revenue would then go to, the way he's allocated it in his budget, some would go to fund transportation, some would go to fund education and other services in the general fund. But as we know from the recent elections, that while Inslee is a Democrat and Democrats control the House, the Republicans have won pretty firm control of the state Senate. And they view all of these proposals to cut greenhouse gas emissions as something that's going to negatively affect their main constituency, which is big business here in the state of Washington. So the Republicans are going to have a heavy pushback on this, and I just don't think it's going to pass. the state legislature this year. It would be great if, as Inslee said, come on, let's buck up. And I saw the headline in the Seattle Times, buck up and pay for the services that we need. It'd be great if the Republicans would buck up and stop whining about how cutting greenhouse gas emissions is going to negatively affect business, blah, 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 and actually do something to save the environment, because this is a big issue here in the state of Washington as it is all around the world.
All right. Also, he came out with a proposed transportation budget.
Two other budgets came out of his office this week. You know, it's the run-up to the state legislative session, which starts in January. So it's time for the governor to make these proposals of things that he wants the legislature to address. The legislature will have to address two budgets coming up in this legislative session. The biannual budget for the state as a whole, and the transportation budget. Now, we're entering year three without a transportation budget. And Governor Inslee decided that he would put forth a plan that would cover 12 years. His budget is a 12-year, $12.1 billion plan. First, I'm going to talk about the expense side of that budget. It has within it $2.6 billion for maintenance, operations, and preservation. Now, that's about a little over 20% of the budget for replacing bridges, maintaining highways, and about half would go to the Washington State Patrol and the ferry system, particularly a ferry system that's been suffering from a lot of maintenance problems, to help replace some aging ferries, excuse me, and to help keep the system running on time, which it's been having some problems with in the past few years. Now, about $2.2 billion of the budget would go for quote-unquote clean transportation and multimodal. That's about 18% of the budget for quote-unquote clean transportation. Of that, $802 million is set aside for transit grants. Now, if you look at that, $802 million seems like a lot, but it's only about 6.7% of the total budget. Now, the rest, about $1.4 billion, would go for bicycles, pedestrian improvements, and for promoting the purchase and use of electronic vehicles, which require a certain amount of infrastructure built around the state, charging stations and so forth. Now, I say $802 million is only 6.7% of the total. When we think about what the governor's task force on carbon emissions just told us, which is that the transportation industry here in the state of Washington accounts for the vast majority of our greenhouse gas emissions. And they came down very heavily in favor of more state funding for transit in particular, to try to get people out of cars and moving away from as much as possible, moving away from individual automobiles, relying on individual automobiles, seeing only 6.7% of the next 12-year budget for transportation devoted to transit is pretty discouraging and pretty draconian, in my opinion. Now, also in this budget is $5.9 billion in new construction. That's almost 50% of the budget set aside, mostly for new highway capacity. So here we have, 6 to 7% for transit versus almost 50% of the next 12 years of the state funding for transportation devoted to building new highway capacity. That's really, and this is the best we can expect from Governor Inslee, our Democratic governor, who said he's really committed to dealing with greenhouse gas emissions and cleaning up our transportation system. This is pretty bad, I really do have to say. Now, on the good side, the expense side of the budget really does allow for more taxing authority for local transit. So Metro Transit will be able to continue asking for more local funding. So will Sound Transit for Sound Transit 3. So will Community Transit and so forth. But really, that's small potatoes compared to $12 billion state budget, half of which is devoted for highway construction. Now, let's look also, you had a question, Mike?
Yeah, so do you see the $6 billion for highway construction as the trade-off to get labor in on this, because I saw in their
press release that was... Inslee, you know, is very... Inslee does have a lot of labor support, and he does count labor groups as a large part of his constituency. So, yes, you could look at it from that perspective, too. Now, the income side of the budget is kind of interesting. There's no gas tax in this budget, so... you could say that it's a real sea change on the income side of the budget. Now, we did talk about this a little bit last week, how the gas tax is a user tax, and it's based on miles driven, and it encourages people to buy more fuel-efficient vehicles and or drive less in order to pay less of the tax. So in a sense, the gas tax is somewhat environmentally friendly. The downfall of the gas tax is that it isn't scaled, it isn't indexed for inflation. So the legislature has to continually pass increases to the gas tax. And it also is very volatile in that when people drive less, they consume less gas, and so they pay less tax, and so the transportation budget suffers. Now, he has proposed a portion of the carbon pollution fee go to the transportation budget, enough to generate about $7 billion over the 12-year plan, plus other fees and bonds, in other words, borrowing money, which is not unusual when you're building infrastructure like highways, to borrow money to do that by issuing bonds. Now, but again, you know, that doesn't. That may be environmentally progressive by taking money generated by carbon polluters, particularly in the transportation industry, using it to fund transportation projects. But again, that doesn't really solve the problem of decreasing revenues. You know, we do want carbon pollution to decrease, which means that the carbon tax will decrease over time as well. And so, of course, the transportation revenue will decrease over time as well. And it could at some point really fall off a cliff, depending on how steep those carbon pollution cuts are. So, and, you know, it's also kind of backwards to tax carbon in order to build more roads. If you look at the budget overall, having a progressive, environmentally progressive revenue to build more highway capacity at a time when people really are on their own choosing to drive less just seems to me really backwards.
Well, maybe indirectly it's part of that Boeing support plan. Better roads to bring the parts in.
Yes, it could be. A lot of people are saying that the additional highway capacity is really meant to be a gift for freight haulers.
Hmm. Which are one of the groups opposing the carbon cap and
yes,
trade plan.
Yes, because as I said last week, that freight hauling companies and companies that rely on have very heavy transportation costs are people who pay the most in terms of the gas tax, but would also pay the most in terms of a carbon pollution tax as well.
All right. How about the proposed state budget?
Now, his overall budget for the state, about $39 billion for the biennium 2015 to 2017, is kind of interesting. The state has estimated that it would have a $2.35 billion shortfall, and that's in addition to any requirements imposed by the state Supreme Court in the McCleary decision for further education funding and the contractually mandated raises for state employees that are due to go into effect over the coming 2 years. Now, the expense side of Inslee's budget shows an increase of $5 billion, most of which is devoted to education under the McCleary decision. So he's proposing that the state fully fund what the state Supreme Court has decided it needs to under the McCleary decision. But it only includes a portion of what's needed to fund Initiative 1351, the recently passed class size initiative. And he's only proposing that the state fund the portion of that overlaps with the McCleary ruling. Now, on the income side, Inslee is proposing a 7% capital gains tax for single people who have capital gains over $25,000 per year and for couples who have capital gains over $50,000 per year. And for folks who don't know, capital gains income is usually generated from the sale of stocks, bonds, and other assets held for investment. Now, it exempts retirement plans, which is good because then it would exempt a lot of people whose main source of income is their pension or their retirement income. It would exempt most home sales, and it would exempt the sales of farmland and forest land. So it wouldn't impact folks whose main asset is their business asset, their who are sole proprietors like farmers and folks who have forest land. Now, it would raise about $800 million to help fund the additional revenue needed to fund that $5 billion that Inslee is increasing in the state budget. He would also raise cigarette taxes by 50 cents a pack to get another $56 million. He would tax e-cigarettes, and he would repeal or limit some tax breaks that businesses get currently, like software royalties, used card trade-ins that are over $10,000 in value, and tax breaks for oil refineries, for example. And he would also like to extend the sales tax to bottled water, which was proposed before, passed, and then was defeated. Now, Washington is only one of nine states that doesn't tax capital gains, so most other states in the U.S. do. And only about 1% of Washington's residents would have to actually pay the tax. That means that, and you know, it would be mostly wealthy people who already pay a smaller portion of their income in state sales taxes than do middle-income people and the poor. So it is a progressive tax. On the other hand, folks have pointed out that the capital gains tax is more volatile, and that during a recession, it might fall off a cliff. So, but, you know, I would like to point out that during a recession, wealthy people tend to do not as bad don't tend to not do as badly as middle and poor people. So we saw a big fall in the state sales tax during the last recession. You could see that with just about anything, including an income tax. Certainly states like the state of California, which relies heavily on an income tax, really struggled during the last recession because their revenue plummeted. I think you're going to see that during any recession, just about any kind of tax that you levy is going to fall. In addition, in addition, you could argue that a tax on the wealthy is less likely to fall or fall drastically during a recession than an overall income tax or a tax based on consumption, which relies heavily on income from poor and middle class people. So I think that should not be the reason to not pass a 7% capital gains tax. I'm kind of happy that Inslee has made this what would seem to be a very radical proposal, at least for the income side of the budget.
All right. Let's move on to national and New York State.
Yeah, New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo announced Wednesday that the state would ban hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, for oil and gas exploration. Oil and gas extraction. Fracking is when you inject water, sand, and usually very, very toxic chemicals, although those chemical compounds are proprietary and we don't really know what chemicals they use, deep into the ground at high pressure in order to fracture rock formations and release oil and gas deposits. New York sits on the Marcellus Shale, which runs beneath several eastern seaboard states. The state's health study found quote-unquote, significant public health risks related to fracking, and said that because we don't know what the chemicals are involved in the fracking process, we really don't know the full extent of the health risks that are involved when those chemicals are released into groundwater, as they seem to be. The state's had a moratorium on fracking for the past 5 to 6 years, but, you know, back in 2012, Cuomo said that he might allow fracking in southern New York in order to help revitalize rural communities there. But dozens of local communities in the state of New York have banned fracking, and those bans, in June were upheld by the state court of appeals, which is the highest court in the state of New York, saying that local communities definitely do have the ability to ban this kind of activity that could severely impact their communities. So Cuomo is extending that ban now statewide. It makes me wonder if other states are going to join that bandwagon. I certainly hope so.
All right. And Congress passing a
$1.1 trillion federal budget late on Saturday night. It increases the limit. There's a lot of things in that budget that are not good. A few of them include an increase on the limit that individuals can contribute to national political parties. Wealthy individuals can now contribute up to $300,000, as if our political campaign system needed even more cash from wealthy donors. The budget also allows banks to avoid stricter regulations on credit swaps and other derivatives instead of being forced under the Dodd-Frank bill to separate those risky investments into subsidiaries that are not covered by federal deposit insurance. Banks would be able to still have those risky investments on their balance sheets. And the major problem here, when you hear progressive analysis of this proposal, the main problem here with the passage of this law is that it allows banks to take these very risky investments, keep them in their companies that are federally insured, and therefore charge their customers a higher rate for those investments because they're less risky investments because they're federally insured. So banks can make a lot more money on them. This just provides more incentive for the banks to go out and issue more and more of these investments and sell them, and therefore piling up more and more risky investments on their balance sheet covered by federal deposit insurance, which means that taxpayers are on the hook for another bailout in the future. It's just really undoing a whole lot of what the Dodd-Frank reform was supposed to be about. In addition, the federal budget includes a provision that will allow employer pension plans to cut retirees' benefits in order to shore up the finances of those plans. That's a bad move. It reduces the budget also for the EPA and the IRS and other state agencies that the Republicans don't like. So there's a whole lot in this budget bill that were giveaways to the Republican Party to get a budget passed before the end of the fiscal year so that the government would not have to go through another shutdown. And I think the Democrats really kind of gave it all away there. But it does allow one good thing in there, snuck deep inside the 6,000-page bill, was a provision to legalize medical marijuana nationwide, the first time that the federal government, that Congress, has voted to allow medical marijuana in every state of the union, which is just opening the door to full legalization, I think. That's actually some good news.
All right. And finally, on international, President Obama making an announcement about Cuba.
Yeah, just very quickly, Obama announced that he would normalize relations with Cuba. We tend to think of Cuba as being that terrible communist country. While we still do probably the bulk of our national business with China, that other terrible communist country, Obama's announcement would allow us to actually do real meaningful trade with Cuba to ease exports on goods like construction, agricultural products, auto repair products, also allow the export of telecommunications equipment to Cuba. The Treasury Department will ease banking restrictions so that Cuba can get foreign loans and trade with other countries. The State Department is going to review Cuba's status and possibly remove Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism from the State Department's list. So a whole host of things that will allow Cuba to literally come out of the 1950s and join the modern economy, which I think is good news. Also this week in international news was the Lima Accord from the Lima Climate Talks, which you could refer to as not so much the Lima Accord, but as the Peer Pressure Accord. All nations from the climate talks in Lima will now be required to produce a plan to cut carbon emissions. However, there's no legally binding limits on what cuts they have to make, so every nation can decide how much or how little to cut. And there's no punishment if a nation fails to put forth a plan by June of next year. Most of the big polluters, however, have said that they are drafting a plan, including the U.S., China, India, and Russia. So we'll see what kind of plans come out of the Lima Accord. I had hoped for something a little bit stronger, but we get what we get. And we'll see if the name and shame features of the Lima Accord actually put enough peer pressure on the world's nations to come up with a decent way to address greenhouse gas emissions.
All right.